down and read counsel and then proceed to the next case. Michael and Son Services, Mr. Mars and Ms. Alcorn. Have you all signed in?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, great. All righty. Well, you each have 15 minutes. Mr. Mars, you go reserve any time for rebuttal?
It is my hope to reserve 3 minutes.
Okay. We'll do our best to help you out with that.
We shall see how well I do with that, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Brad Mars. I'm here representing the appellant, Surge Center of Silver Spring. I would note that Surge Center is an ambulatory surgery center, and it is not the physician practice, and its billings do not include the physician's billings. In this case, we're appealing to seek reversal of a split opinion from the Workers' Compensation Commission and final judgment for the claim amount of $73,768. In 2012, this court issued its opinion in Ceres Marine Terminals versus Armstrong. I hope I'm pronouncing Ceres correctly. There were two key tenets of law that were reaffirmed in the Ceres Marine case governing medical provider claims before the commission. Number one, that provider billings begin with a presumption in their favor to establish the prima facie case so that the burden of proof shifts to employers to justify their short payments. Number two, that once the employer comes forth with evidence, the adjudication of whether the charges were in accord with prevailing community rates will be determined on a factual basis according to data drawn from the charges of providers in the community, not from what insurers or government agencies may prefer to pay. The commission ruling in this case represents a substantial undermining of Ceres Marine on both of these points.
Mr. Mars, let me interrupt you for just a minute. In terms of Ceres Marine, one of the things that this court followed up with in orthopedics is essentially to indicate that while we do have the presumption that in terms of the reasonableness of bills, there's also the possibility that the presumption doesn't apply. So would you agree that the commission could find that the presumption simply does not apply?
I would say that the commission could hold that, but that would be reviewed according to whether the law were accurately applied. And that is not a factual inquiry. It's a legal test when you're talking about whether the presumption is discarded or not. That would be our first argument, Your Honor, that we believe the commission erred in casually depriving Surge Center of the benefit of its presumption, especially with respect to its rates of charge due to an innocent mistake over a line item in the billing.
So there are certain characterizations of fact that the presumption or the finding body has to examine, would that be fair to say, in terms of determining whether the presumption is actually applicable?
I think, you know, in any rule of law, you're going to apply that law to the facts in the record, yes.
So I guess the question is, it appears from reading the commission's decision, what the commission essentially says is, or said, is that the presumption did not apply because of this error in the bill. And I know there's a characterization you're making that it's innocent, but could the commission come to a different conclusion in reference to that error that would prevent the presumption from being applicable?
We think that the commission misapplied the unpublished opinion from the Fredericksburg Orthopedic. And one of the things that I'd like to point out for your consideration is that any bill of any kind, in particular in the medical context, has two components. There's going to be the question of what you're charging for. Those are the line items, in this case designated by the CPT codes, and also what the rates are for each line item. The legal presumption that's been announced, although this may not have been articulated before, but the legal presumption encompasses both of those elements. Now, if we take the evidence in this case in the light most favorable to the employer, as admittedly we must, then according to the witness affidavit submitted by the employer, one of the line items here was submitted, quote, in error. Now, there's no evidence of any sort of programmatic problem or any sort of bad faith. There may be embellishments of counsel, but if we look at the evidence and construe the evidence, even most favorably to the employer, all we have is an error as to that line item. And I might point out That error was brought up in the context of the employer's submissions that tacitly accepted all of the other line items. No challenge presented as to the other line items. Now, we would argue that as a matter of law, there's nothing about challenging one of several line items that would justify, as a point of law, the commission discarding the presumption as to the rates applied to the line items. Two different things. There's the line items and there's the rates of charge. If you compare this to Fredericksburg Orthopedic, in Fredericksburg Orthopedic, there was some concern that perhaps the provider was gaming the system, that they had one set of charges for everybody else and one set for workers' comp patients.
Can't the fact finder find that the inaccuracy in that particular item, in this particular case, it was a procedure that did not occur, that was actually billed, might actually skew the ability for the presumption to actually apply? There may be a question as to the validity of the other parts of the bill.
No, we don't think they can. That is taking the Fredericksburg Orthopedic case way too far. And I do note that it's an unpublished decision, not as heavily scrutinized. But I think if you look at the facts that the court was ruling upon in that case, I know that there are some providers who will argue that workers' comp billings are much more administrative headache and that there's a justification for charging higher rates. But in that case, there was evidence that the provider was charging 40% more to workers' comp patients than to all of its other patients.
Right. They said as much. They essentially said
they admitted it.
Charged as much because it cost more, but there was essentially no proof to indicate what the markup of that cost would be.
Right, and where there's something programmatic going on and where they're clearly evading the prevailing community rate structure by having a second set of rates applicable only in the workers' comp context, you can see what the concern was in that situation. That concern is simply not present in this case. And to apply that standard to this case creates a landscape where any nit that can be picked in a bill, any good faith dispute over the evidence could result in loss of the presumption.
Service that wasn't performed is hardly picking a nit, is it?
Relative to the amount, it's a clerical error. I mean, all indications are it's a clerical error.
I mean, that would be search centers to spin on it, was that it was a clerical error.
Well, that's all the evidence shows.
To get back to Judge Malo's conclusion, that doesn't have to be what the fact finder decides.
Well, there's absolutely no evidence that would have supported any finding of malice or wrongdoing. And certainly where there's...
It would be legitimate for that to raise eyebrows as concerned with the rest of the building, would it not?
If it did, then the employer had the opportunity to bring that forth and did not. And the employer's submission tacitly accepted every other line item, and the concern turned to the rates of charge. What we're concerned with is Surge Center looked at the employer's evidence and said, you know what, we are going to let that go. I would think the court's approach to that would be to encourage litigants to be gracious in that manner. Instead, we've got the ruling that says no good deed goes unpunished. Perhaps we should have fought that thing to the death instead in order to maintain our purity. But what we're going to do
to
fight that particular line item to the death.
If it's for a service that wasn't performed, how do you defend the indefensible?
Well, I don't know that it wasn't performed. There are a number of codes that are sometimes debatable as to whether they can be billed additionally or whether they're included within the scope of other codes. And coding is not an exact science. Now, none of that evidence was developed below.
Yeah, well, I thought it was conceded on brief that this was a service that was not performed.
It was conceded that it was billed in error. It was not conceded that it wasn't performed. And so the exact reason why it was in the bill was never developed because we just said, we'll let it go. Now, had we gotten into all of that, it might have been developed. But one of the reasons we didn't get into all of that is that the employer made it clear up front that they weren't challenging the other line items. Not only did they tacitly do that by not attacking them, but they made it clear in their opening filing that they weren't going to ask for wholesale throwing out of the presumption. And what's more, the initial deputy commissioner opinion never took that issue up. That issue didn't come up until much, much later. That's why we've argued that it was waived. But
Mr. Morris, I think Judge Malvo had a question that I'm not sure you answered.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the question I have for you is in reference to the operative notes and compared to the bill, you're indicating that there's no concession to be made that it didn't occur, but it seems pretty plain that that was something that didn't occur. And so the question in a broader scheme is, why couldn't the trier of fact take that into consideration?
I don't know that there's any evidence on that point. Again, whether it's merely a coding error where it was actually undertaken but included within another code, that was never developed in the record. And it, even if we take the evidence most favorably to the employer, there's simply nothing to support that. And the employer's own evidence says it was included in error, but doesn't describe what that error was. Once Surge Center drops back from that, it ceased to be an issue in the case. And it wasn't until much later when that was brought up at the very end after having been waived, and it was taken up by the commission after our opportunities to contest that issue had gone by the boards, that we got to that point. I would like to also argue our second concern here, which is that the employer's evidence, and especially with respect to the expert, Mr. Moore, are rife with flaws, and many of those, granted, go to weight of the evidence, and we acknowledge that before the commission, strict rules of evidence do not apply. But one of them in particular is on a point of law and should be reviewed de novo. And our concern there is that Mr. Moore's testimony was basically used as a Trojan horse to advance what had previously been made as a legal argument rejected in Ceres Marine, and that is that really prevailing community rate analyses ought not to be governed by charge data, but by what people pay. And in particular, at Joint Appendix page 150, Mr. Moore made clear that when he looked at prevailing community rates in his opinion, he was looking at what people negotiate for as the quote-unquote real test. Also, at Joint Appendix page 156, when discussing markups on medical implant devices, he made clear that the quote-unquote industry standard that he was talking about was not the industry standard of ambulatory surgery centers or of any medical providers. It was the industry standard of the insurance industry, what they like to pay in response to that. And that approach is simply presenting information that is not relevant under the Ceres Marine point of law. What he's supposed to be talking about is what providers charge, not what he, as a career negotiator of bills, thinks is fair to pay. And that's why his evidence was not properly before the commission and should not have been embraced. We do believe that the presumption should be reinstated as to the uncontested part of Surge Center's bills as far as the uncontested line items. As to the rates,
your rebuttal time.
I see that, and I think I may save 2 minutes, okay. Judge Decker. But we also feel that if you look at Mr. Moore's evidence, if you look at his testimony, and in particular not so much at his summary affidavit, which included information he later had to acknowledge was falsified, if we look at that and realize that he's really trying to sneak in charge data as the test instead of payment data, we realize this is not merely a matter of weight of the evidence. This is a matter of a point of law being argued. And the fact that it's been moved from briefs to a transcript doesn't change the fact that it's not the law. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Katharina Alcorn, and in this particular case, I represent Michael & Son Services, Inc., the employer and Accident Fund Insurance Company of America, the workers' compensation carrier. As a preliminary kind of benchmark, this court, as you know, gives great weight and deference on appeal to the commission's construction of the Workers' Comp Act, and has routinely accepted the commission's general rule that medical bills are considered prima facie evidence of reasonableness. The commission routinely accepts medical bills. In my years of practice doing this for 12 years in front of the Workers' Comp Commission, I can only recall one or two instances where they did not accept the medical provider's bill as prima facie evidence. On occasion, the commission has ruled that a provider's improperly billed a line item and simply removed that line item from consideration and awarded the balance. I was able to find one full commission opinion where they did that, and that was Deborah Cradle versus Home Recovery of Virginia. And in that particular case, the commission, after hearing evidence, determined that an assistant was not medically necessary. So the assistant's charges were redacted from the overall bill, and the case proceeded forward. The factual circumstances in this case require a different result. But before we get into that, I do want to clarify, because the providers argued here that we, or the employer and carrier, essentially waived certain defenses. And so during the on-the-record hearing at the trial level, there were five defenses that were advanced. One was that the bill charges exceeded the prevailing community rate. Two was that the bill charge for the implant was unreasonable. A third was that the improperly billed allograft code. There was another defense related to the neuromonitoring, which included three separate CPT codes. And then we also specifically included a portion in our brief that advanced that the provider's prima facie case had been refuted. That particular defense was never waived. I know on brief the provider has argued that a conclusory statement somehow waived the entirety of that two-page portion of our initial brief. That's just simply not the case. The carrier submitted the facts to support why the presumption should be forfeited, and then argument advancing why several other cases factually were similar.
Counsel, just as a point of clarification, the brief does talk about the forfeiture of the presumption. That's not exactly what Fredericksburg Orthopedic talks about, though.
Correct, but I think that it's Fredericksburg Orthopedic, I was actually counsel on that case, and that case essentially advanced on the fact pattern that the provider was billing a surcharge for the administrative headache associated with workers' comp. And there was a lot of evidence developed in that case that there wasn't any malice. They weren't trying to game the workers' comp system, but rather there was factual circumstances associated with workers' comp cases that made it a little bit different. And in that particular case, the medical provider argued, okay, fine, if the surcharge is inappropriate, then just remove the surcharge and award us our normal bill charge. And this court and the commission refused to do that on the basis that once there's a billing irregularity, then the presumption doesn't apply to reasonableness. And the burden essentially stays with the provider to establish the prevailing community rate. So in this particular case, by billing a code for a service that was not performed, the commission didn't punitively punish the provider and deny their claim, but rather said, we're not going to take your bill at face value. The burden stays with you to establish reasonableness. And I would advance that had they introduced any evidence at all to explain why that bill charge was included, the commission would have been able to consider it and potentially strike just that line item. But by remaining silent, the only evidence that was advanced was that they billed a service for which they did not perform. And it wasn't just a concession. It wasn't just an error. Additional evidence that was submitted was both the surgeon and the assistant, the professionals in the room, didn't bill those codes. And that's important because we need to remember that the provider in this case is a brick-and-mortar facility. This is not a doctor. So the only services that could potentially be rendered are what the professionals did in the building.
Did the commissioner find specifically that there was a charge for a service not performed?
Yes. It was a factual determination based on the evidence in front of it. And it wasn't just on the concession. There's been a lot.
By
the deputy commissioner and by the full commission. And there's been some argument that that determination was just based on the provider's concession. But I don't believe that it's limited just to the concession. It's based on the affidavit of Donald Hope that specifically reviewed the operative note and concluded that that service had not been rendered by the facility. Additional evidence, like I said, was that the surgeon did not bill for that, the assistant did not bill for that, and in combination, that was sufficient for the deputy commissioner and for the full commission to conclude that the service had not been rendered. But looking at the prima facie issue, the presumption forfeiture argument, I believe that the determination about whether or not a medical bill was prima facie evidence that the charge fees in the case were reasonable and necessary is a factual determination. And as a factual determination, it's reviewed by this court based on a credible evidence standard. And there's clearly sufficient evidence in the record to establish that this was a service that was not rendered. And this isn't kind of unique. The commission has held that billing irregularities by providers will forfeit the presumption. There's on brief several cases that support that proposition. And I won't go through those now. I'll rely just on the brief for that. But like I said, there's credible evidence in the record of improper billing. Now, one of the issues is whether or not you can cure this billing irregularity by striking it. Clearly, the commission could have done that, but they elected not to do so in this case. And I think that's primarily because there wasn't any evidence to establish why was this included in the billing. And this court's role is not to go back and to reweigh the evidence. It's a factual determination made by the commission. Now, the prevailing community rate standard 605, the commission has looked at that case that statute. There have been several cases on point interpreting it. This case is a little bit different. Now, there's been a lot of argument about whether or not Mr. Moore looked at the appropriate standard. I don't think there's any question in the record. He repeatedly testified during his deposition that he looked at providers' charge data. Yes, he had some commentary about the standard in general. Yes, he had some commentary about whether or not he believed things were reasonable. That's fine. But he did have testimony directly on point that his analysis as it relates to the prevailing community rate was based on self-reported provider charge data. And that the specific points in the joint appendix is outlined in brief. Really what I think the issue is, and it hasn't specifically been addressed by counsel in his brief, is this case is factually a little bit different than we normally see. Normally the commission will have a statistician that will review charge data and make a statistical analysis. But the statute doesn't require there to be a statistical underpinning to the prevailing community rate. On occasion, the commission has reviewed testimony from either another doctor, as in the Brian Hill case, where a doctor reviewed, the same doctor in this case, Dr. Hope, reviewed what other providers were charging and gave just a general statement of assistant surgeon charges at a 20% level. The commission, in some instances, even when we advance evidence of database statistical analysis, has taken a provider's lay testimony about what other providers are charging and determined that that, when weighing the evidence, was given greater weight than the actual statistical analysis. The whole point of this is to establish that, one, the statute doesn't require data, and two, the commission is really tasked with weighing the evidence. They have never had a rule that said the only way you establish is the prevailing community rate is through statistical analysis. Rather, they look at what's advanced in each particular case. Sometimes they look to data, and that's sufficient. In other cases, they'll reject data and look to lay testimony. Now, in this particular case, I think the unique argument or the unique point of law is related to similar treatment. Now, Mr. Moore testified that as opposed to a review based on CPT code lines, because this is a brick and mortar facility, you really should be looking at episodes of care, because you're not looking at a professional that's doing a service, but rather a brick and mortar facility, what are they charging? And they looked at, or Mr. Moore looked at and testified, that the appropriate consideration for similar treatment as that phrase is used in 605 should be based on an episodes of care. He testified that the provider billed based on revenue codes and CPT codes, but really what you want to get to is what are other brick-and-mortar facilities charging for this type of fusion? And he testified that certain APC or DRG codes were appropriate to define the episode of care. And the reason that all of that is important is because the provider did not really refute those classifications as defining the episode of care, but rather said this provider billed with CPT codes, and that's industry standard. But that doesn't really attack what the meat of Mr. Moore's testimony was. What is the episode of care? And when he looked at the episode of care, based on self-reported provider charge data, he concluded that this provider was billing in excess of the prevailing community rate. The commission, when reviewing that testimony, found him credible, and that is sufficient evidence in the record to establish the prevailing community rate. We also need to keep in mind that Mr. Moore testified about the facility charges in general, but then he separated that from the implant charges. And so it appears that counsel is trying to meld all those back together in regards to, if Mr. Moore is talking about reimbursement for a reasonable implant fee, that somehow will taint his testimony as it relates to the prevailing community rate for the facility charges. We need to keep those two entities separate. The commission was able to do that. And for those reasons, I believe that it should be affirmed. Now, one of the other issues that's been brought up on brief is the community area that was used. And this is an out-of-state provider, was not located in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Providers that are in the Commonwealth fall within Rule 14 that established geographic boundaries. In this particular case, because they were outside of the area, it was really left up to counsel to argue what was the appropriate level or region to be classified as a community area. Mr. Moore explained that he looked at Silver Spring and then he expanded it to include additional geographic area and additional data. The commission thought that that was reasonable, and there's credible evidence that was submitted to support that ruling as well. If there are no other questions, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Moore, you have about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Judge.
And 58 seconds.
I won't accelerate my pace, I promise. Again, there are two elements to the presumption that was upheld in Sarah's Marine. There's the line items being charged, and there's the rates of charge. Even in a case like this one where there's some concern over one of the line items charged, there's no logical reason to extend that to the rates of charge. And while Ms. Alcorn may believe, and she wants to opine, that there was some sort of something going on with respect to the billing, what the record shows is that her witness said it was billed in error, that it was then withdrawn and ceased to be a point of discussion. The record was not further developed. And yes, the deputy commissioner said it was for services not performed. That may be a conclusion to which she leaped, but it is not a conclusion supported by the record. There's no evidence on that point. It was simply not developed, and we maintain it was not developed because the issue was withdrawn. As Ms. Alcorn has made clear, there have been cases where one line item was attacked, taken out of the claim, and the rest went forward. There was no indication that this would be handled any differently. It certainly was not the sort of programmatic overcharging that we saw in Fredericksburg Orthopedic. One of the other things I'd like to point out is that with respect to Mr. Moore, because of his hostility to the Sarah's Marine requirement that he look at charge data and not payment data, to allow his opinions to stand will lead everyone out there with a roadmap on how to do an end run around Sarah's Marine. While he made some claims that he was looking at charge data, his detailed testimony failed to show that he had any within the correct community, as the dissent by the Commissioner Marshall, I believe, aptly pointed out. And I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and greet the counsel, and that's before we adjourn.